Chapter 5. The greatest trap of all, to live with that which thou hast wrought, the price and process of atrocity. The psychological trauma of living with what one has done to one's fellow man may represent the most significant toll taken by atrocity. Those who commit atrocity have made a Faustian bargain with evil. They have sold their conscience, their future, and their peace of mind for a brief, fleeting, self-destructive advantage. Sections of this study have been devoted to examining the remarkable power of man's resistance to kill, to the psychological leverage and manipulation required to get men to kill, and to the trauma resulting from it. Once we have taken all these things into consideration, then we can see that the psychological burden of committing atrocities must be tremendous. But let me make it absolutely clear that this examination of the trauma associated with killing is in no way intended to belittle or downplay the horror and trauma of those who have suffered from atrocity. The focus here is to obtain an understanding of the processes associated with atrocity, an understanding that is in no way intended to slight the pain and suffering of atrocity's victims. The cost of compliance. The killer can be empowered by his killing, but ultimately, often years later, he must bear the emotional burden of guilt that he has buried with his acts. This guilt becomes virtually unavoidable when the killer's side has lost and must answer for his actions, which, as we have seen, is one of the reasons that forcing participation in atrocities is such a strangely effective way of motivating men in combat. Here we see a German soldier who, years later, has to face the enormity of his actions. He retains a stark image of the burning of some peasant huts in Russia, their owners still inside them. We saw the children and the women with their babies, and then I heard the poof of the flame had broken through the thatched roof, and there was a yellow-brown smoke column going up into the air. It didn't hit me all that much then, but when I think of it now, I slaughtered those people. I murdered them. John Keegan and Richard Holmes, soldiers. The guilt and trauma of an average human being who is forced to murder innocent civilians doesn't necessarily have to wait years before they well up into revulsion and rebellion. Sometimes the executioner cannot resist the forces that cause him to kill, but the still small voice of humanity and guilt wins out shortly thereafter. And if the soldier truly acknowledges the magnitude of his crime, he must rebel violently. As a World War II intelligence officer, Glenn Gray interviewed a German defector who was morally awakened by his participation in an execution. I shall always remember the face of a German soldier when he described such a drastic awakening. At the time we picked him up for investigation, in 1944, he was fighting with the French Marquis against his own people. To my question concerning his motives for deserting to the French resistance, he responded by describing his earlier involvement in German reprisal raids upon the French. On one such raid, his unit was ordered to burn a village and allow none of the villagers to escape, as he told how women and children were shot as they fled screaming from the flames of their burning homes. The soldier's face was contorted in painful fashion, and he was nearly unable to breathe. It was quite clear that this extreme experience had shocked him into full awareness of his own guilt, a guilt that he feared he would never atone. At the moment of that awakening, he did not have the courage or resolution to hinder the massacre, but his desertion to the resistance soon after was evidence of a radically new course. On rare occasions, those who are commanded to execute human beings have the remarkable moral fiber necessary to stare directly in the face of the obedience demanding authority and refuse to kill. These situations represent such a degree of moral courage that they sometimes become legendary. Precise narratives of a soldier's personal kills are usually very hard to extract in an interview. But in the case of individuals who refuse to participate in acts that they consider to be wrong, the soldiers are usually extremely proud of their actions and are pleased to tell their story. Early in this study, we saw the World War I veteran who took tremendous pride in outsmarting the army and intentionally missing while a member of a firing squad. And we saw the Contra mercenary who was overjoyed that he and his comrades spontaneously decided to intentionally miss a boat full of civilians. A veteran of the Christian militia in Lebanon had several personal kills that he was quite willing to tell me about, but he also had a situation in which he was ordered to fire in a car and refused to do so. He was unsure of who was in the car, and he was proud to say that he actually went to the stockade rather than kill in this situation. All of us would like to believe that we would not participate in atrocities, that we would deny our friends and leaders and even turn our weapons on them if need be. But there are profound processes involved that prevent such confrontation of peers and leaders in atrocity circumstance. The first involves group absolution and peer pressure. In a way, the obedience-demanding authority, the killer, and his peers are all diffusing their responsibility among themselves. The authority is protected from the trauma of and responsibility for killing because others do the dirty work. The killer can rationalize that the responsibility really belongs to the authority and that his guilt is diffused among everyone who stands beside him and pulls the trigger with him. This diffusion of responsibility and group absolution of guilt is the basic psychological leverage that makes all firing squads and most atrocity situations function. Group absolution can work within a group of strangers, as in a firing squad situation. But if an individual is bonded to the group, then peer pressure interacts with group absolution in such a way as to almost force atrocity participation. Thus, it is extraordinarily difficult for a man who is bonded by links of mutual affection and interdependence to break away and openly refuse to participate in what the group is doing, even if it is killing innocent women and children. Another powerful process that ensures compliance in atrocity situations is the impact of terrorism and self-preservation. The shock and horror of seeing unprovoked violent death meted out creates a deep atavistic fear in human beings. Through atrocity, the oppressed population can be numbed into a learned helplessness state of submission and compliance. The effect on the atrocity-committing soldiers appears to be very similar. Human life is profoundly cheapened by these acts, and the soldier realizes that one of the lives that has been cheapened is his own. At some level, the soldier knows, there but for the grace of God go I, and he recognizes with a deep, gut-level empathy that one of those screaming, twitching, flopping, bleeding, horror-struck human bodies could easily be his. And the cost of noncompliance. Glenn Gray notes what may have been one of the most remarkable refusals to participate in an atrocity in recorded history. In the Netherlands, the Dutch tell of a German soldier who was a member of an execution squad ordered to shoot at innocent hostages. Suddenly, he stepped out of rank and refused to participate in the execution. On the spot, he was charged with treason by the officer in charge and was placed with the hostages, where he was promptly executed by his comrades. In an act, the soldier had abandoned once and for all the security of the group and exposed himself to the ultimate demands of freedom. He responded in the crucial moment to the voice of conscience and was no longer driven by external commands. We can only guess what must have been the influence of his deed upon slayers and slain. At all events, it was surely not slight, and those who hear of the episode cannot fail to be inspired. Here, in its finest form, we see the potential for goodness that exists in all human beings. Overcoming group pressure, obedience-demanding authority, and the instinct of self-preservation, this German soldier gives us hope for mankind and makes us just a little proud to be of the same species. This ultimately may be the price of noncompliance for those men of conscience trapped in a group or nation that is itself trapped in the dead-end horror of the atrocity cycle. The greatest challenge of all, to pay the price of freedom. Quote, "Let us set for ourselves a standard so high that it will be a glory to live up to it, and then let us live up to it and add a new laurel to the crown of America." Woodrow Wilson. In the same way, every soldier who refuses to kill in combat, secretly or openly, represents the latent potential for nobility in mankind. And yet, it is a paradoxically dangerous potential if the forces of freedom and humanity must face those whose unrestrained killing is empowered by atrocities. The good that is not willing to overcome its resistance to killing in the face of an undeniable evil may be ultimately destined for destruction. Those who cherish liberty, justice, and truth must recognize that there is another force at large in this world. There is a twisted logic and power resident in the forces of oppression, injustice, and deceit. But those who claim this power are trapped in a spiral of destruction and denial that must ultimately destroy them and any victims that they can pull with them into the abyss. Those who value individual human life and dignity must recognize from whence they draw their strength. And if they are forced to make war, they must do so with as much concern for innocent lives as humanly possible. They must not be tempted or antagonized into treading the treacherous and counterproductive path of atrocities. For, as Gray put it, their brutality made fighting the Germans much easier, whereas ours weakened the will and confused the intellect. Unless a group is prepared to totally dedicate itself to the twisted logic of atrocity, it will not gain even the short-sighted advantages of that logic, but will instead be immediately weakened and confused by its own inconsistency and hypocrisy. There are no half measures when one sells one's soul. Atrocity, this close-range murder of the innocent and helpless, is the most repulsive act of war, and that which resides within man and permits him to perform these acts is the most repulsive aspect of mankind. We must not permit ourselves to be attracted to it, nor can we, in our revulsion, ignore it. Ultimately, the purpose of this section and of this study has been to look at this ugliest aspect of war, that we might know it, name it, and confront it. This let us pray for, this implore, that all base dreams thrust out at door, we may in loftier aims excel, and, like men waking from a spell, grow stronger, nobler than before, when there is peace. Austin Dobson, World War I veteran, When There Is Peace.